smart French man never been to school. Wanna get some fun in a Creole town. Stop and let me show you your way around. Let the bon ton lay. Let the moulin lay. Now don't you be no fool. Let the bon ton lay. I got a Creole girl, well she's one fine dish. But she's got ways like a mean crawfish. She don't do nothing but raise sand all night. But when it comes to loving, she's much alright. She let the bon ton lay. She let the moulin lay. No, don't you be no fool. Let the bon ton lay.
Good morning, everyone. You're tuned to WOWDLP Tacoma Park, 94.3 on your FM dial. This is Sheila Blake, and I'm with my husband, Peter Blake. Tom, my radio partner, is on vacation, so today we are the hosts of the Artist Experience Radio Show. The Artist Experience Radio program has a unique mission. We investigate the inward experiences of engagement with art, and we desire to make them explicit, both in the creator and in you, our listeners. Tom, when he's here, and I are trying to demystify art, making your art adventure richer and more enjoyable whenever you experience the visual. We try to bring to light the art experience, unfolding it into larger, brighter, more richly contoured surfaces, transforming vague awareness into definite knowledge. We have an Artist Experience page on Facebook, where we put images of the things we're talking about. It's also a place we'd love you, our listeners, to give us ideas and feedback. Please look at it if you can while you're listening. And you can stream the program at tacomaradio.org. Also, we're putting podcasts of this show on my website, sheilablake.com, and on artistexperience.com so that you can listen at any time. And the podcasts can also be found at iTunes. So, in a couple of recent shows, we've talked about the writings and influences of the British art critic John Ruskin. He was a passionate advocate of an art based in close observation of nature, with a capital N for nature, and a fierce opponent of the movement Art for Art's Sake that we identified last time with James McNeil Whistler. I said then, and I thought it was kind of wonderful that art ideas were so passionately argued.
Well, now at the Hirshhorn is an exhibition that focuses directly on passionate art arguments. The series of manifestos written over the last century, manifestos for each emergent avant-garde, the futurists, the dadaists, the surrealists, objectivists, abstract expressionists, and on into the present era. And what a giddy fountain of words poured forth from those activists.
So let's pause for a minute and acknowledge that this word manifesto has been in the news a lot lately, connected with the horrible shootings in Dayton and El Paso last weekend. It has taken on, from that very incident, a dark emotional color. We'd like to take back that word if we can, because the exhibition at the Hirshhorn is about art manifestos, and it is titled Manifesto. Some commentators have recently said that the media is wrong in using this word, which used to imply something much greater, and instead should call these writings by a more accurate name, rants.
Rants and unhinged screeds. Well, many in the media are trying to wake this country up and get some changes made. I know you all will join us in wishing for an end to this madness. But let's return to our foray into art history at the Hirshhorn. At the literal center of this exhibit are the words themselves, excerpts from about 40 manifestos in a multi-screen installation. It's written and directed by Julian Rosenfeld. The manifestos are recited by the actor Kate Blanchett in 13 short videos, in which Blanchett takes on 13 roles, such as a floor trader on a stock exchange or a puppet maker. She does both male and female roles, as she did in Todd Haynes' movie I'm Not There, portraying the multiple personas of Bob Dylan. And the films are shot with a brilliant cinematography on amazing locations, architectural locations, all of which, Blanchett, the words, the locations, make for a kind of surrealist dream itself. Our show today will explore the theme of artist manifestos, those strident and poetic documents written by the artists or by art-obsessed philosophical poets, starting 100 years ago, establishing the principles of each new avant-garde. They are wonderful and kooky, often a bit silly, sometimes very serious and technical.
Are any art ideas taken seriously today? We have reviews and essays by critics and curators and letters to the editor at Art Forum, the most influential publication for the past several decades. Artists and critics are always trying to put into words what is essential about an art that they are champions for. It's also essential for the art market. Sometimes the words are more important than the art. But why does this matter? Okay, so at the end of World War I, the Dada movement took apart the longtime assumptions of European art, which was still in the Victorian era, and Marcel Duchamp challenged it with his urinal. You know about that. Okay, very right. Famous. He took a urinal and signed it Art Mutt and said, this is art. So what? Why do people still go to art museums and galleries? Well, when I was a kid, the Monet water lilies were installed in the Museum of Modern Art and everyone went. And you saw the results. Those dappled violets and yellows and blues and greens and textiles and socks and note cards and pocketbooks and mugs and puzzles. Later, Mondrian was everywhere. That was in the 60s. He was on pocketbooks and clothing and pens. But these artists were high art. So Andy Warhol broke down the barrier between high and low. Now there are artists who do this marketing for themselves on the internet, making art, which they sell as art. And then they sell their products, which are based on the designs, on tea towels and God knows what.
What is art for? It's a big question, a perennial question, a permanent question. I think about it all the time. And so have poets, philosophers, and artists through the centuries. These manifestos, each one has a new answer. Each one is urgently telling us how to make art newly relevant to the current needs of the people and of the time. There have been so many manifestos, some overlapping, but overall providing a great variety of prescriptions for making art newly important. In the first half of the 20th century, the era of modernism, there was widespread belief that art was progressing toward its truest and purest state, that artists were plumbing the depths of the soul and the heights of the imagination and creating objects of greater and greater simplicity and purity. In the second half of the last century, continuing into the present, in the postmodern age, we tend to see these things historically and realize that there is no underlying reality, no single direction of progress. But that, as Emerson described, there are ever-widening circles of imaginative understanding. There will never be an end to exploration. So my reaction to the cacophony, it shows the infinite variety of the imagination and of art. There are a lot of things art can't do. If politics is the art of getting people to change their minds, art isn't a very powerful political force anymore.
Although, those red hats at the rallies, they do make a statement.
Yes. Let's begin at the beginning with futurism. Futurism, created in 1909, has a claim to be the first recognized artistic manifesto. Although, of course, you can find earlier writing praising some and damning others. But for a true manifesto, on the level of the Communist Manifesto, perhaps the Futurist Manifesto was the beginning. It is creative. It has some trenchant observation about art. However, there is in it a praise of violence, which very few of us would find agreeable, particularly when we realize that it led to fascism. However, it is of historical interest. Art had a part in the road to fascism. How is that possible? But it is. There's a lot to be learned in studying the dependence of both Italian fascism and German Nazism on art. The Nazi leadership took art very seriously. That is, they believed in the power of art and were determined to control it and use it in the inspiration and control of the people and the development of a new humankind. I think that might be a key. Anytime a visionary writer or politician is talking rapturously about the new man or the new woman, watch out. It was the basis of all the totalitarian regimes of the 20th century. It's interesting, in contrast, I heard a Russian journalist recently explain that today, in our postmodern age, Putin's strategy is completely different. He puts on television multiple competing opinions by respectable-looking experts, all of which are completely mad. He is trying to create a population that shrugs their shoulders and says, well, nobody knows anything.
Well, Nazi art was bad. It was kitsch, and kitsch is actually a German word. But the art of Italian futurism was good. I mean, it was beautiful. The first piece in this exhibit is a futurist sculpture by Giacomo Balla. It's called Baccioni's Fist, Lines of Force, 2. It's very abstract. It has a lot of movement and force. It's sleek, a sleek form. It's very cool, a metal sculpture with hard, sharp edges painted red. It just looks great. What I didn't get, but later learned, is that the abstract geometric style is derived in part from the streams of light and air caused by the passage of a speeding car, the lines of speed and force. It was named for Umberto Baccioni, who was Balla's student and a leading theorist of futurism. This sculpture translates Baccioni's idea of the body into an abstract form in motion. The figure strides ahead vigorously, riding the wave of the future. His fist is thrust out in front of him to physically break the bonds with the past. I had to read that to get it.
Further into the room, there's a hanging wall sculpture, also by Balla, resembling metal waves, also with sharp edges, jutting out of the wall. The guard ran over to me, waving his arm, saying in a conspiratorial whisper that I was too close. My toes were over the line. He also said that you, too, Sheila, needed watching. I'll just say it was a strange energy in that room.
Well, about this point in the program, I didn't know you'd said that.
Yeah.
At this point in the program, we thought we might begin with some of the Futurist Manifesto. It's interesting and provocative in an art historical way, but we decided instead that another manifesto by the same author, Filippo Marinetti, would give a stronger flavor of the strange utopian vision and just a hint of the dark side. So, Peter, will you read this manifesto?
I will. So I'm going to read a manifesto from the futurist Filippo Tommaso Marinetti, Against Pasta. And this is not tongue-in-cheek. He was being serious, so, but here it is. Futurism has been defined by us as innovative Italian pride, being the formula for original life and art, the religion of speed, humanity's maximum drive toward synthesis, health of the spirit, a method for continuous creativity, fast-moving geometrical splendor, and aesthetics of the machine. Contrary to established practice, therefore, we futurists disregard the example and cautiousness of tradition so that, at all costs, we can invent something new, even though it may be judged by all as madness. Though we recognize that great things have been achieved in the past by men who were poorly fed or who survived on coarse victuals, we assert this truth. What we think or dream or do is determined by what we eat and what we drink. On this subject, let us consult our lips, our tongue, our palate, our taste buds, our gastric juices, and let us enter, in a spirit of originality, the world of gastric chemistry. We futurists sense that for the male, the pleasure of love is found in plumbing the depths from top to bottom, whereas for the female, it is fanned out horizontally. Gastronomic pleasure, on the other hand, for both the male and the female, is always upward from the bottom to the top of the human body. And furthermore, we think it necessary to prevent Italian men from becoming stolid, leaden hunks, dull and insensitive. They need to be more in tune with the Italian female, who is slender, spiraling, transparency of passion, tenderness, light, strong will, impulsiveness, and heroic tenacity. We must make the Italian body agile, in keeping with the super lightweight aluminum trains that will take the place of the heavy iron, wood, and steel trains currently in use. We futurists are convinced that in the likely event of future wars, it will be the most lithe, agile people who will be victorious. We are establishing a diet in keeping with an increasingly airborne, faster pace of life. Above all, we believe it is necessary to be rid of pasta, that idiotic gastronomic fetish of the Italians. It may well be that cod, roast beef, and puddings are good for the English, and that the same goes for the Dutch with their meat cooked with cheese, or the Germans with their sauerkraut, smoked speck, and cotelette. But pasta is not good for the Italians. It contradicts, for example, the lively spirit and the passionate, generous, intuitive nature of the Neapolitans. They have been heroic fighters, inspired artists, powerful orators, sharp-witted lawyers, and industrious farmers, in spite of their mountains of pasta every day. By eating it, they develop their characteristic, ironical, emotional skepticism, which often crushes their exuberance. A very intelligent Neapolitan professor, Dr. Signorelli, has written, "Unlike bread and rice, pasta is a food that is swallowed and not chewed. This starchy food, for the most part, is digested by the saliva in the mouth, and the task of conversion is carried out by the pancreas and the liver. This leads to an imbalance and consequently has negative effects on these organs. It induces sluggishness, depression, inertia brought on by nostalgia and neutralism. An invitation to the chemists. Pasta, which is 40% less nutritious than meat, fish, and vegetables, binds the Italians of today with its knotty strands to the languid looms of Penelope and to somnolent sails waiting for a wind. What is the point of continuing to let its heavy bulk stand against that immense network of long and short waves that Italian genius has flung over the oceans and continents, against those landscapes of color, form, and sound which the radio television circumnavigates the earth? The apologists for pasta carry its leaden ball, its ruins, in their stomachs, like prisoners serving a life sentence, or archaeologists. We invite the chemical industry to do its duty and very soon provide the body with all the calories it needs by means of nutritional equivalents supplied free of charge by the state in the form of pills or powders, albuminous compounds, synthetic fats, and vitamins. We shall thus arrive at a real reduction in the cost of living and of wages, with a corresponding reduction in the number of working hours. Today, the production of 2,000 kilowatts requires only one workman. Machines will soon constitute an obedient workforce of iron, steel, and aluminum at the service of mankind, which will be relieved almost entirely of manual labor. This, being reduced to 2 or 3 hours, will allow the refinement and the exaltation of the other hours through thought, the arts, and the anticipation of perfect meals.
Wow. Well, think about that next time you order a delicious pasta dish. So if you just joined us, Peter and I are discussing a current exhibition at the Hirshhorn Museum entitled Manifesto, Art and Agency. It was organized by the Hirshhorn's chief curator, Stefan Aquin. The exhibition includes the movie Manifesto by German artist Joseph Rosenfeld, presented as a multi-channel film. And along with more than 100 works of art created over a 100-year period, Manifesto, Art and Agency explores how artists used manifestos to engage with the political and social issues of the time, and how contemporary practices still employ art as a tool in the making of history. So, since this show is at the Hirshhorn Museum, and many people living in and visiting Washington know this three-story donut on the mall, I think it's good to know where this museum came from. So Joseph Hirshhorn, he was the 12th of 13 children and was born in Latvia. His father died when he was a baby, and his mother brought all the kids to New York, and he was a street kid. When he was 10, he was running errands for Wall Street brokers. And when he was 14, he was an office boy, and by the time he was 16, he was a broker. He was hell-bent on helping his family out of poverty. By the time he was in his 40s, he was incredibly wealthy from uranium mining investments. He also fell in love with collecting art. He began building his collection from classic French Impressionism to works by living artists, American modernism of the 20th century, and sculptures. Then in 1955, Hirshhorn sold his uranium interests for more than $50 million. He expanded his collection to warehouses, an apartment in New York City, and an estate in Greenwich, Connecticut, with an extensive land for sculpture. Joe Hirshhorn was a small man in a big hurry. He'd go to an artist's studio, and he didn't have time to study each painting. He'd buy everything in the room. He'd say, just, I'll take it all. And he made quick decisions on buying a piece. He said, if you've got to look at a picture a dozen times before you make up your mind, there's something wrong with you or something wrong with the picture. He was obsessed with art. He also learned, but he saw himself as a quick looker. I used to think that his taste was very much in evidence in his collection, especially when they first opened the museum, and it was only his collection. And he seemed to have a preference for pink and brown, and sometimes with gold. And he didn't necessarily buy the best painting of a particular artist, and he really didn't get subtlety. So in 1966, Hirshhorn donated much of his collection, 6,000 paintings and sculptures from the 19th and 20th century, constituting one of the world's largest private art treasures of the 20th century. And he gave it to the United States government along with a $2 million endowment. The Smithsonian Institution established the Joseph H. Hirshhorn Museum and Sculpture Garden in Washington to hold the collection. The museum opened in 1974. The building itself is an attraction. It's an open cylinder elevated on four massive legs with a large fountain occupying the central courtyard, which is really kind of dreary. It doesn't have light in it. It's like a central courtyard. And they haven't really found a use for it. Sometimes they put out tables, but nobody wants to sit at them. But the interior three floors of the donut circles is pretty wonderful because you're always moving forward and you're never trapped in rooms. Before architect Gordon Bunshaft designed the building, the Smithsonian staff reportedly told him that if he did not provide a striking contrast to everything else in the city, it would be unfit for housing a modern art collection. And it does stand out. At Hirshhorn's death in 1981, he willed an additional 6,000 works and $5 million endowment to the museum. When the museum came under a new directorship, they were able to sell off some of the original collection and acquire new work. The museum has changed so much since 1966. Their aim under a new director, Melissa Chu, is to be a powerhouse in contemporary art, and they're doing it. This show might be seen as a way of educating the public to see and learn about the contemporary movements and the touchstones leading to the present. Because, as we said many times, some background and knowledge is important in understanding non-objective art. In 2006, the late, great Kirk Varnadeau, who was a distinguished art historian and chief curator of MoMA and a scholar at Princeton's Institute for Advanced Study, gave a series of 6 mail-in lectures at the National Gallery of Art. It's also in book form. They are called Pictures of Nothing. They were stunning lectures, and Varna Doe begins by asking, can there be a philosophy of abstract art as compelling as E.H. Gombrich's argument for illusionism, which was the main text, the history of art? And he asks, what is abstract art good for? And finally, what do we get out of abstract art? And there's one answer, irresponsible joy of the aesthetic experience. Varna Doe begins with Jackson Pollock at a key moment in the emergence of a new form of abstract art in the mid-1950s and builds a compelling argument for a history and evaluation of late 20th century art that challenges the distinctions between abstraction and representation, modernism, postmodernism, minimalism, and pop.
So look for that book, Pictures of Nothing by Kirk Varna Doe. You could also probably see the videos of the lectures in the library at the National Gallery if you asked nicely.
The first part of this exhibit at the Hirshhorn is really pretty great. The timeline on the wall is an account of the big events that occurred from the beginning of the 20th century in Europe to the present and how the art movements responded to those events. The work, sculpture and flat work from the Hirshhorn collection, is terrific, and it demonstrates the different movements up until the present. But they really didn't need a reason to display this work. In the middle of the exhibit is a huge space that has video screens, each projecting Cate Blanchett and various personas reciting manifestos. It is loud. Some artists like to talk and expound. The abstract expressionists were famous for their drunken arguments at the Cedar Bar, and some don't like to talk. Edward Hopper's wife, Jo, said that talking to him was like dropping a stone into a well and waiting for it to hit bottom. Paul Cézanne wrote down a few of his rules of painting which seemed to contradict his painting. And at the end of his life, young artists would come and visit him, make the big trek, and he would turn them away. Some write in order to help in the appreciation of their work, and some write manifestos, a public declaration of often grandiose aims. Wassily Kandinsky, who is considered the father of abstraction, published a lot. Kandinsky defines 3 types of painting: impressions, improvisations, and compositions. While impressions are based on an external reality that serves as a starting point, improvisations and compositions depict images emergent from the unconscious, though composition is developed from a more formal point of view. Kandinsky compares the spiritual life of humanity to a pyramid. The artist has a mission to lead others to the pinnacle with his work. The point of the pyramid is those few great artists. It is a spiritual pyramid advancing and ascending slowly, even if it sometimes appears immobile. During decadent periods, the soul sinks to the bottom of the pyramid. Humanity searches only for external success, ignoring spiritual forces. I'm going to quote Kandinsky. Colors on the painter's palette evoke a double effect, a purely physical effect on the eye, which is charmed by the beauty of colors, similar to the joyful impression when we eat a delicacy. This effect can be much deeper, causing a vibration of the soul or an inner resonance, a spiritual effect in which the color touches the soul itself. In 1915, Kazimir Malevich laid down the foundations of suprematism, which he published his manifesto, From Cubism to Suprematism. You can listen to Cate recite it in segment 7 of the video installation. Suprematism sought to develop a form of expression that moved as far as possible from the world of natural forms and subject matter in order to access the supremacy of pure feeling and spirituality. He was noted for what was considered the first non-objective painting, Black Square. Using modern technology of infrared and X-ray, it appears that underneath the surface of the black square, he explored colorful compositions until he arrived at the pure black square.
It's a famous painting, because still people wonder, is this a joke? It seems like a joke on the bourgeoisie, a black square. Now, it was an approach to purity.
Okay, so now we're going to take a station break, and we'll play a little music and do a little talking.
Oh, show us the way to the next whiskey bar.
Oh, don't ask why. Oh, don't ask why.
For we must find the next whiskey bar. For if we don't find the next whiskey bar,
I tell you we must die.
I tell you, we must die. Oh, moon of Alabama, we now must say goodbye. We've lost our good old mama and must have whiskey, oh, you know why.
Why? Oh, don't ask why.
For we must find the next pretty boy. For if we don't find the next pretty boy,
I tell you we must die. I tell you we must die.
I tell you we must die.
Oh. Welcome back. This is Artist Experience on WOWD 94.3 FM, and we're talking about the exhibit on art manifestos at the Hirshhorn Museum. It's on until January 2020. Peter, will you describe more of the exhibit?
Sure. The second room of the manifesto exhibit is devoted to Dada. Futurism had promoted war. It promoted the First World War as a solution to the decadence of Europe and society. We know how that turned out. Death and the destruction of society turned out not to be short, cleansing and uplifting, as predicted by all sorts of the educated, literary, and museum-going elites, and not just the futurists. Dada was a response. The shock at what was lost, and how the powers, institutions, and the literate and artistic elites had brought about this disaster, led to a rejection of the standards of behavior and thought that the European elites had lived by. In this exhibit, we come next to several anti-war drawings by George Grosz. They are caricatures of the underlying decadence and violence he saw in the ruling class. They made a permanent impression in the world. The second Dada Manifesto was recited by Tristan Zara at the Salle Mez on March 23rd, 1918. Artists are the only people who have a chance to become citizens of the world, to make a good world to live in. So that was the aim. Dada rejected the logic, reason, and aestheticism of modern capitalist society, instead expressing nonsense, irrationality, and anti-bourgeois protest. And a quote, "And so Dada was born of a need for independence, of a distrust toward unity. Those who are with us preserve their freedom. We recognize no theory. We have enough cubist and futurist academies, laboratories of formal ideas. It is the aim of art to make money and cajole the nice bourgeois. Cubism was born out of the simple way of looking at an object. Cezanne painted a cup 20 centimeters below his eyes. The cubists look at it from above. Others complicate appearance by making a perpendicular section and arranging it conscientiously on the side. The futurist sees the same cup in movement, a succession of objects one beside the others, and maliciously adds a few lines of force. This does not prevent the canvas from being a good or bad painting, suitable for the investment of intellectual capital. The new painter creates a world, a sober, definite world, without argument. So that was from the Dada manifesto. We had just pointed out that the drawings of George Gross had a strong argument, so obviously the Dada movement encompassed and included a large range of aims and principles. In the next room, third room, work inspired by objectivist and surrealist movements. By this point, I'm not reading any more wall text. I'm fascinated by the sculptures and paintings. There's a sculpture by a young Isamu Noguchi. The surface looked like stone. It may have been some kind of ceramic. It had colored light emitting from slits and openings, plus wire and cork spheres hanging from promontories, which somewhat resembled breasts. This is nothing like Noguchi's gorgeous, pure, abstract sculpture that is in the lobby of the East Wing of the National Gallery, but it was fascinating, beautiful, and mysterious. Also a little old-fashioned in a science fiction sort of way. Maybe that was the influence of objectivism. I don't know, but I liked it a lot, and I liked the Joan Miró paintings as we passed into surrealism. You know, contemplating these manifestos brings a mixed emotional quality. There's something dark and repellent and claustrophobic in these utopian chants. Taking them together in their poetry, in their stridency and the conflict between them, and considering the background of the horrible, horrible European wars, there's something depressing. But also, just as we can get through that and be thrilled by Faulkner or Dostoevsky, we can be fascinated by and enjoy the Baroque complex intensity of people possessed by ideas, possessed by the art demons. They might be demons of light and justice, but possessed by the need to set the world right.
Joseph Hirshhorn had a huge collection of abstract expressionist paintings. It's good to see them. The loosely connected group of painters, most at one time influenced by Hans Hofmann, who was the most influential teacher. Artists such as Jackson Pollock, Willem de Kooning, Franz Klein, Lee Krasner, Robert Motherwell, William Baziotes, Mark Rothko, Barnett Newman, Adolf Gottlieb, and Clifford Still, they gave themselves the name Abstract Expressionists, and they assembled with critics to give themselves an identity and something for them to write about. Even though they were each very different as artists, they were very distinguishable from one another, but they had many things in common. They broke away from the conventions of technique and subject, and the paint was a reflection of their individual psyches. And in doing so, they attempted to tap into the universal inner sources. The battle is in evidence, construction, destruction, until the final resolution of the painting. Directness of expression was paramount. It was best achieved through lack of premeditation. In a famous letter to the New York Times in 1943, Gottlieb and Rothko, with the assistance of Newman, wrote, "To us, art is an adventure into an unknown world of the imagination, which is fancy-free and violently opposed to common sense. There is no such thing as a good painting about nothing. We assert that the subject is critical. The subject here is the inner psyche." It's pretty exciting.
So what about Hans Hofmann? I enjoyed the Hans Hofmann painting in the exhibit. But you thought it was what? Too illustrative?
Yes, I did.
It did seem very much an abstract underwater reef. I guess I have a similar taste to Joseph Hirshhorn. It's like a boy's taste, a taste for sharks and baseball.
Well, Hans Hofmann was the influential teacher. He was powerfully influenced by Matisse's use of color and Cubism's displacement of form. He came from Europe during the Second World War, and he developed an artistic approach and theory that he called push and pull, which he described as interdependent relationships between form, color, and space. The color and line and form were constantly in contention for primacy. So there's a constant tension, which is at the heart of the work of his disciples. You can see it in these works. It's key. Everything is pushing itself forward or receding, and it's doing this constantly, so that your eye never really settles down. There's a Helen Frankenthaler painting that's terrific. I never saw it before. It's an early one, painted with sand, and you can see the constant weaving in and out of the ghost-like forms and lines. And then there's a wonderful Mondrian.
Yeah, I agree. And these particular paintings are worth a visit because they are not usually on view.
Right.
The manifestos that are referenced in the exhibit and recited in the film, they are taking aim at the high-low scale of art. Art generally occupies a high space in our society. In many respects, it resembles religion and is often talked about with spiritual terms. It also resembles competitive sports in that it is competitive, and most attempts to reach the high place are repelled by those who are already there and their allies. They're comfortable, inspired, engaged, alive, amused, and deeply moved, and they resist opening up the top space. But art is also an activity available to all. Engagement with the world as it is, with beauty, with imagination, it's an activity that fulfills and energizes both the artists and their fans and brings about new relations with the world. So the new actors are always clamoring for the rules to change. But there is always the scale of good versus mediocre. And there are dimensions, other scales, like the habitual versus discovery, exclusive versus inclusive, universal versus individual versus community, many, many dimensions. And many of the manifestos want to open up the high place to new people, and new visions. They want the art world to change its priorities and elevate a new dimension or scale as the important one. Now, one big exception to this is Marcel Duchamp. And to some extent, Dada. They did something different. They attacked the high-low scale itself. So they were saying, there are no high places. All places are the same. The vision is in the observer, or should be. The world doesn't need genius. We don't need to depend on a trained virtuoso genius to produce art for us. It's all around us. And I'd say this is an excellent point. It opens our eyes. So you can go to a concert by John Cage. He was a follower, I think, of Marcel Duchamp. He also thought, let's get rid of genius. Let's create works of art through the operation of chance operations. He did have a little influence on the attractiveness by choosing, say, instruments that went well together, a sound that sounded good with chance notes. But it was his work teaches us. But at any rate, eventually most art goers put these ideas aside because we do want the higher intensity of artistic experience that genius can provide.
But the artists associated with Dada, they did have a high level of design skill. They were European trained artists, and they also had great imaginations. And they didn't always hide this training. I mean, their work is just beautiful, period,
yeah.
In a graphic sense. And Andy Warhol, he was an excellent designer. He was a master of color. He knew how to make an impact, yet he pretended to be feckless. In his aggressive passivity, he became a major influence. The avant-garde is moving right along, out with the old abstract expressionism and color field and in with the new pop art. And with it, the art market. What used to determine the value of art, the artist's hand, the virtuoso artist who is technically skilled, the indisputable beauty, the rarity of the work, pop art promoted the idea of mass production, no trace of the artist's hand, so that the value placed on art is up for grabs. Roy Lichtenstein, who is really one of my favorite artists, he comments on all of this in his work. He sort of basically remakes art history, commenting on all these different movements through his sort of comic book language. And just as we love to watch athletes because they do the impossible, we know how difficult the graceful motions and actions are to achieve in athletics. We love to watch artists because we know we could never do what they do. And even though the artists of the second part of the 20th century challenged their audience to think they could do it, or their 9-year-old grandchild could do it, I say, try it. Besides, they had the idea first. So, in our attempt to learn if all these words have any impact at all, well, Walter Gropius had the most profound influence on the 20th century. He says, the ultimate goal of all art is the building. Here, architecture is placed in the foreground and declared the most important goal. And this is reflected in the word Bauhaus, which is a blend of the verb to build and the noun house. Many, including myself, are of the opinion that the invention of this wonderfully powerful word is one of Gropius' most important creative achievements. Today, the term Bauhaus is no longer translated into any other language, but it leads a life of its own. His ideas of design and architecture can be seen in the development of a clean, efficient housing for the working class. Get rid of the frou-frou. Good design can change your life. I also want to talk about the Guerrilla Girls, which began with a women's movement in the 1960s to address the huge inequality of women in the arts. They used rambunctious humor to grab attention. And you know, progress has been made. Many of the new museum directors are women. I think that there might be more than 3% of women's artists on museum walls by now. A recent data survey of the permanent collections of 18 prominent art museums in the U.S. found that out of over 10,000 artists, 87% are male, 85% are white, only 13.7% of living artists represented by galleries in Europe and North America are women. There used to be a firm belief that women just didn't have this ineffable thing that could make an artist, that painting almost like a man was a high compliment. Just as Georgia O'Keeffe was our token woman artist, now we have more tokens. And although the National Gallery brought a wonderful painting by the New York artist Cecily Brown, they displayed it for a couple of months, and who knows what storage unit it now occupies. Now we have some world-class African-American artist, Martin Puryear, who's representing the United States in the Venice Biennale, and Kerry James Marshall, Kehinde Wiley, who did the portrait of Obama in the Smithsonian, Faith Ringgold, Kerry Weems, Kara Walker. These are the artists we know about. Imagine how many are lost. But slowly, things are changing. I hope. Well, we can talk a little bit about something that I was hoping we would have time for. And there was a movie called I Shot Andy Warhol. And it's a true movie starring Lily Taylor. And it's a movie about Valerie Solanas. And she had written a manifesto called the Scum Manifesto. I think it's something like Society for Cutting Up Men.
Yes. Yeah.
And it was written in 1967 and published in 1968, the year she shot and wounded Andy Warhol. In the movie, she's portrayed as a real nutjob, and I think she is, but she was driven to get Andy to read and publish her manifesto, and she was so certain that if he read it, she would have the fame that she wanted. But the thing is that she hung around with Andy in the factory for a while, but then he got sick of her, and he kind of because he is who he is, he kind of just shut her out. And she had all her hopes pinned on him recognizing her, and she would stalk him. She'd come to restaurants where he was with his friends talking, and he would just like look the other way and say, get rid of her, get her out of here. And she was so desperate, and assuming that's why she shot him, and she wounded him very badly. He did sort of recover, but he never really recovered his health, and that led to an early death. So, but the truth is that since she did shoot him, that it, her manifesto is available on the internet if you want to read it. There are other manifestos. There's a manifesto by the Bread and Puppet Theater, which is called the Cheap Art Manifesto. And it says, people have been thinking too long that art is a privilege of the museums and the rich. Art is not business. It stresses the positive nature of art, which is beneficial to all and should be available to all, using poetic images such as art is like green trees and urging art fights against war and stupidity. Art is cheap. So for our next show, I hope you've enjoyed this show. I hope it's not too dark. But our next show, I think that we will be discussing puppets, which is in particularly great. Yeah, because I just mentioned the Bread and Puppet Theater.
Yeah.
And there's a puppeteer here in Washington that is going to invite us to her studio, and hopefully we'll get some good stuff for you guys. And I want you to stay tuned for our next exciting programming with WOWDLP Tacoma Park featuring Bobby Hill. This music, and Bobby shares an incredible knowledge of music depth with his music program on Saturdays, every Saturday from 10 until 1 p.m. Avant-garde jazz right here. And experience art and the visual in everything you do. Thanks for listening, and see you in 2 weeks.
Kiss on the hand may be quite continental, but diamonds are a girl's best friend. Kiss may be grand, but it won't pay the rental on your humble flat or help you at the automat. Men grow cold, these girls grow old. We all lose our charm in the end. But square cut or pear shape, these rocks don't lose their shape. Diamonds are a girl's best friend. Diamonds are a girl's best friend. Let's rock. There may come a time when the lass needs a lawyer. Diamonds are a girl's best friend. There may come a time when a hard-boiled employer thinks you're awful nice, but get that ice or else no dice. He's your guy, stocks are high, but beware when they start to descend. It's then that those louses go back to their spouses. Diamonds are a girl's best friend. 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 Let's rock again.